James Cameron, welcome to Studio 360.
Hey, this is great.
So you have been famously burning to make this movie for a long, long time. Well, why were you so passionate about this?
Well, this is kind of a dream project for me because it's sort of the sum total of my childhood and my teenage years, all the fantasy and science fiction books that I read, and you know, being an artist in the sense of being a figurative artist and painter, illustrator. I was constantly drawing these alien creatures and robots and spaceships and everything. That's just kind of where my head was for that whole period. And so for me, it was a return to a kind of classic sci-fi, a classic fantasy that I hadn't really done, because I'd done the Terminator films, which were kind of, you know, kind of edgy, you know, kind of, we called it tech-noir.
And pure sci-fi as opposed to fantasy.
Yeah, exactly. And this has a real fantasy component to it, even to the extent that parts of it are quite dreamlike and beautiful and transportive, not in the way that a sci-fi thriller like the Terminator films or Aliens would be, although it has elements of that as well.
You've made big, technologically, narratively ambitious movies. Does this feel like the biggest?
It was certainly the most complex.
Yeah.
You know, it was a big Rubik's Cube with a lot of moving parts between the stereoscopic 3D live-action photography, the CG performance capture work that was done completely separately from that. Then there was kind of an interzone between those where we were mixing CG and live-action together that used even additional techniques. And then there was the length of it, because it was a 4.5-year project, the first 2 years of which was just designing all the elements and creatures and landscapes of this world and developing the technology to be able to do it. I didn't even start with the actors until after the first 2 years.
And so you call it a 4.5-year film. At 4.5 years ago, did you know that the technology, computational power, all of it was there, was going to be there?
It wasn't there in a turnkey way. It was certainly on the cusp of being what we needed it to be. But we also believed that we had to push it farther than what had been done before. So we brought some of our own ideas to it, and we developed our own process and our own pipeline, building on what had been done previously.
But you were a little bit waiting for Moore's Law to sort of meet you.
Absolutely. I can give you an example. Titanic took, and this is a simple example, a very nuts and bolts example. Titanic took 2 terabytes of memory to be able to do all the visual effects in that movie. And Avatar took 1,000 terabytes or a petabyte. And it's, to my knowledge, the first film that's required that much storage. Wow. And that's just one tiny example.
And to give a sense of what a petabyte is, for instance, the Large Hadron Collider is producing 15 petabytes of data, I think, a year?
Yeah.
So that's a lot of data.
Yeah, it's a lot of data.
You're using, as you're suggesting, this entirely new kind of 3D cinema technology that you're calling Real-D. How, in a relatively simplified way, does that differ from the 3D that's been around since we were children?
Well, let's go on a little history of 3D then. Okay, it started out a long time ago with the kind of red and blue, you know, paper, cardboard glasses.
That you felt like an idiot wearing.
Everybody felt like an idiot, plus it produced headaches because it was just not a good process. The two-color process, a terrible process. And you know, in more recent years, with the advent of digital projectors, just really in the last 4 or 5 years, and using polarized glasses, you're able to have an experience in a movie theater that doesn't produce a headache, if the 3D is authored properly in the first place. But the projection is excellent. And Real-D is one of these processes that's out there right now that you can see. There's also a Dolby process that's excellent. And there's the IMAX digital process, which is excellent. So, you know, you're able to go to any one of these theaters, whether it's IMAX or Real-D or Dolby, and have a spectacular experience. Of course, it still depends on how good is the film.
Yeah.
You know.
How is your technology different from these other proprietary ones? Why is it better or different?
Right. Well, I was just talking about we didn't develop a theater projection technique.
So you're talking about the projection technology.
That was just all because
right.
You mentioned Real-D, which is a projection technique.
Gotcha.
What we created was a camera system, which we call Fusion, the Fusion camera system, and it took us about 8 years to develop. And it gives us, because it's got all, it's a 9-axis motion control system with all these servos that control the lenses and the spatial positioning of the cameras, and it's light enough and quiet enough that I can actually shoot with it on my shoulder, just like a normal movie camera.
And it's got a cable to some giant computer behind
it. Well, it's got a cable to where we do the recording, which we call the engineering station. And that cable's about as big as the cable that's on this pair of headphones right here. It's actually a fiber optic cable, and it can be up to several miles long. So it's a very lightweight, easy-to-use system. And I like to operate myself, so I would do the handheld, and you can go on a dolly or anything else, all the normal cinema tools. And, you know, it took us a while to get to this level, but it was a full-on cinema-grade stereoscopic camera. And really, I think the best one that's out there, because we designed it to be able to do movies of the highest caliber.
And one of the things you should be praised for with this film, I think, is the great restraint you showed. There aren't a lot of those moments of, whoa,
the thing
is coming through the screen.
Well, yeah, I mean, most of these 3D movies, you know, seem to want to bounce tennis balls off your forehead every 2 seconds, you know. And all that does is remind you that you're sitting in a movie theater wearing a pair of glasses, you know, because you feel like stuff's coming out into the audience, and now you're aware of the audience, aware of the theater,
yes,
and aware of the glasses. I wanted to have a kind of amnesia where once you go through that window into that reality, into that stereoscopic reality, you've forgotten about the fact that you're watching a 3D movie in a movie theater.
No, I found myself almost grateful a couple of times to be reminded with little motes and stuff floating. Mm-hmm. That, oh, yeah, right, 3D.
Yeah, right. I mean, we like to drift stuff by, but it doesn't intrude too much in the experience. Part of the reason that we used some restraint, as you say, and treated it conservatively is because I knew it was going to be about a 2.5-hour movie. It turned out to be 2 hours and 41 minutes, including all the endless, you know, credits at the end. But you got about 2.5 hours of program, and you don't want people developing, you know, eye strain or headaches or anything. So we had to be very, very careful and have a very mature art in our 3D.
So you didn't want it, even though it is the first of its kind, you didn't want to have that kind of overplay that first of their kinds often do.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And certainly there have been good 3D films done in the last few years,
but
mostly animated,
exactly,
right? Not live action. There were a couple of shorter, smaller live action films made, like Final Destination 4, Journey to the Center of the Earth. I think the distinction with Avatar is that, you know, I'm considered to be a serious filmmaker, so for a serious filmmaker to make a movie in 3D, it has to not intrude into the cinematic experience. And it can't be a 3D experience first. It has to be a movie first. It has to be a real movie with real drama, real characters, and powerful emotions first and foremost. And, oh, by the way, it's also in 3D.
Yeah.
And that, to me, was the approach that I had to take as a filmmaker.
Well, I am not an easy lay when it comes to having my tears jerked, and I choked up several times in this film.
Good. Well, that's why the glasses are dark.
Well,
so
there
that
you
nobody
go.
Sees you.
Exactly. Although, of course, one still has to, if one wears glasses, has to put on glasses over glasses.
Glasses over glasses, right.
Lots of people will see this film in 2D because it's playing at normal movie theaters as well.
Absolutely.
And certainly when they see it at home when DVDs come out. How inferior do you think that experience is?
I think, you know, 95% of my filmmakers' decisions on a movie, on any movie, or certainly on this movie, have nothing to do with 3D. You know, the lighting, the composition, the acting, camera placement, camera movement, the design of the creatures, design of the world, design of the characters. You know, so all of those things are still going to exist, and our 2D prints look spectacular. They look more beautiful than anything we were able to put out on Titanic, just because the technology in that area has improved so much. So I feel very good about the 2D experience. It's just that if you want to spend, you know, $2 or $3 extra and see it in 3D, that's better.
Yeah.
You know, but it's not 10 times better.
Right.
It's not even twice as good. It's just better.
It's $2 or $3 worth better.
It's $2 or $3 worth better. So as a percentage of the total, it's 25% better.
Now, presumably other filmmakers will want to get their hands on this. How will they do that? Do they pay you a royalty, or how does that work?
Well, we're more than happy to supply Fusion cameras and tech support to anybody that wants to shoot a movie in 3D, a live-action film. In terms of the performance capture, while we were doing it, once we sort of had it figured out, we invited many filmmakers to come in and see what we were doing. We just considered it completely open source. We didn't hold it close in a proprietary sense, because we figured, what the heck, if we get more people doing this, they'll advance the tools. Everything will get better. When I come back to it again the next time, the software will be better, everything will be quicker, more efficient, and all that, because each new movie that's made using any of these techniques, you know, pushes the ball further downfield. The only exception to that, of course, is Weta Digital, who did all of the finish animation work on the
and that's Peter Jackson's
company, yeah, in Wellington,
Hobbit
New Zealand
entity.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a spectacular place, and we had 800 computer artists down there working on this movie. But the reason I say it's the exception is that Weta has certain proprietary software that they used on this film.
Well, what I felt myself being eager to see, as extraordinary, awesome as this film is the next movies that are maybe smaller, that aren't trying to do such a giant blockbustery thing.
Yeah, but see, these tools can be used on a movie of any scale to tell a story. You can create beautiful CG character, maybe only a single character. Maybe it's a human character who's being aged through a film, maybe not aged backwards like in Benjamin Button, but aged forwards. You know, maybe Clint Eastwood wants to do a movie as an actor where he appears at the age of 15 and at the age of 35. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
This can be easily done right now, and that would be on a picture that presumably overall would be on a smaller scale.
And it doesn't, because you have done this thing to get the minutiae of facial expression better than has been done, it doesn't have that, to me, disappointing quality of things like the Polar Express.
Yeah, I don't want to diss any individual movie. And
oh, yes, you do. Come
certainly,
on.
No, because Bob Zemeckis was a pioneer in this area.
Who directed that film.
Yeah, and he was the first one to go out there and say, this is real. This is something. I don't mean that the end result was real, but I mean this is a real technology. This is a real way to make movies.
Right.
And he did that on Polar Express. He followed it up on Beowulf. He just charged out. He just grabbed the flag and ran.
And it's beta version.
Yeah, and I respect that. And I don't think he was going for photorealism. I think he was going for this kind of magical, semi-animated kind of feeling. And that's fine. We had a tougher challenge on Avatar because we were mixing photographic scenes, live-action scenes, with CG. So those CG characters had to look photoreal.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was our goal, was photoreality. And sometimes you achieve it, sometimes you don't. But I think that with this movie, I feel satisfied that we achieved it enough.
Are there moments that you look at and go, I wish I could have gotten it better, more perfect in this instance?
There were more flinch moments when I was watching it on a scene-by-scene, shot-by-shot basis. Now when I see the movie in a flow, I don't feel it anymore. I feel like once that train leaves the station and you're getting moved along by the narrative and you're with these people, it's as real as it needs to be.
Are you addicted now to this? I mean, can you imagine making a non-3D film?
Sure, absolutely. I think it's just another set of tools. I like it, and I can think of many, many improvements to the process. And so, you know, I'm very process-oriented, just kind of in the way I think, the way I work. And just the idea of doing another film like this, whether it's another Avatar film or whether it's a film that has the same type of technical challenges, just to sort of make the tool set better, just to sort of improve the process, make it more efficient. That's actually something that's kind of geekily exciting to me.
Yeah.
You know?
I think there's a lot of geeky excitement to you. You had experts
dream. I take that as a compliment.
I give it as a compliment. You hired academic experts to help you dream up the geology and the botany, the biology, all these physical aspects. The plants. Did you ever feel like I'm geeking out too much here? I'm going overboard.
You can't. I mean, not for the hardcore fans of this type of fantasy who want a persistent world that's self-referential and consistent and detailed. And there are a lot of science fiction fans, and by science fiction, I mean hardcore science fiction fans that actually want the math to work.
Yes.
You know, want the physics to work.
Yeah.
But it was all done sort of as reverse engineering. You know, I proposed, okay, there are floating mountains in this movie. Now, you, Mr. Astrophysicist, figure out how I can have floating
mountains.
Well,
by the way, I wanted the explanation for that. How do those mountains float?
All right. Well, you want the explanation? There's this mineral called unobtainium, which is a room temperature superconductor.
Which is what we earthlings are mining
there.
That's
what we're trying to get there, and there's a lot of it on this planet. It doesn't exist in our solar system. We need to go there to get it. A room temperature superconductor is something that theoretically could exist, but we have found no example of it on Earth. and a superconductor will float in a powerful magnetic field. So we talk about the flux vortex and these powerful magnetic fields that mess up everybody's instruments and all that. That's what's lifting.
Uh-huh. I can relax.
Exactly. Now you know that it actually was thought out.
Well, and in a different sense, I was impressed by detail, which is to say, late in the film, you show your hero, Jake's paraplegic hero's legs. They seemed
atrophied
in a way that big husky guy wouldn't be. That was deliberate, huh?
Those legs were actually cast from the legs of a real paraplegic who has no use of his legs, who is the same size as Sam Worthington. So that's what Sam's legs would have looked like. I mean, what Jake's legs would truly have looked like. And it's really tragic when you see that, you know. We used to have an image earlier in the film where you saw them fairly early on. It seemed powerful to hold back and remind you at that exact moment in the film of really what he's up against.
Yeah, it worked absolutely. And I doubt that people less geeky, professionally observant than I probably would notice. You invented so all these plants and animals, geology, these floating mountains. Yet culturally and socially, the Na'vi, these alien creatures, seem very familiar. I mean, they are these Aboriginal people who hunt and gather and wear feathers and beads and loincloths. Why are they so much like American Indians, effectively?
Well, they're actually a melange of indigenous cultures. We looked at indigenous cultures in the Amazon, in Indonesia, in Africa, in America. I think giving them bows and arrows probably places them in most people's minds, you know, in your Native American sort of cultural niche. But in fact, there are lots of cultures around the world that use bows and arrows. It's actually a fairly common sort of first technology for hunting.
But you chose to stick to earth-familiar indigenous peoples. That was a choice.
Yeah, absolutely. I just felt it made it more resonant with our world and with the theme of this is how we treat nature, this is how we treat indigenous cultures. We have a sense of this idea that we can just go anywhere and take anything we need if we can militarily. I don't mean we meaning America. I mean we meaning every superior society in history.
From the Spanish in the 16th
Romans,
century.
The Spanish, the English, the Portuguese. I mean, there's no one here in the so-called civilized world that's without sin in this regard. And it's a sense of entitlement.
Absolutely.
That extends to our overall view of nature and our interaction with nature, that we own it.
But in 2009, yes, the Romans, yes, the British, yes, the Spanish, the Portuguese, Dutch, everyone else. However, in 2009, one sees this film as, I did anyway, the biggest budget anti-imperialist, arguably anti-American film ever.
It's not anti-American. I love...
Put out by Fox.
No, there's an irony for you. Look, I'm a Canadian citizen, but I've lived in the U.S. for 37 years.
And you're not a famously lefty, squishy, liberal guy.
Not particularly, and I do believe in having a powerful military and having a good defense system. I felt that, to simplify it right down to its essence, I think Afghanistan is a just war and Iraq wasn't. And I think it's about how our leaders, are or are not accountable to the American people, and they were not accountable to the American people correctly when we went into Iraq. And Iraq was I consider not a just war. So I threw in a couple of digs, you know, at the Bush administration intentionally. But, you know, that's not really the main theme of the film. I mean, I've also got some visual references to Vietnam, another war that, you know, in my teenage years I thought was insane. And I don't think anybody can really accurately describe why we should have been in Vietnam now after the fact in any way that makes any sense.
Especially
whatsoever.
As there were no natural resources for us to get.
Yeah, there wasn't even any unobtainium there.
Some people say, scholars and others, that the Western film ended in the Vietnam era because of Vietnam and has now been replaced by the science fiction film. And seeing this film, I can see it in that scheme. This is kind of a Western, really.
Yeah, I mean, basically when Star Wars came along, it turned all science fiction films into Westerns in the sense that they became these kind of epic, mythic, kind of heroic shoot-em-ups. When science fiction used to be quite cautionary, quite dystopian, there was always a message or a warning or, you know, some kind of cautionary message in a science fiction film. And that went away when Star Wars became the highest grossing film in history.
Yeah, the Blade Runners of the world didn't really, you know.
Yeah, it became escapist fiction, you know. And I think Avatar actually sort of blends the two streams back together. At least that's how I view it, which is that it's got this sort of cautionary tale quality to it. But at the same time, it's just good, clean fun and, yeah, and big time adventure in the old school tradition.
Why do you think Westerns, literal Westerns, as a filmmaking staple, as a Hollywood staple, went away?
You know, I don't know, and I'm not a film scholar to really be able to, you know, accurately analyze this. I think maybe there was a feeling that it had just been explored, that the themes became so familiar. Maybe there was a sense that we were now at such a remove from that actual historical time that it just wasn't relevant anymore, and that there was enough else going on in the world that we needed to focus on.
This film, Avatar, is set in 2254, 145 years in the future. Your human characters, however, speak absolutely circa 2009 language.
Yeah, yeah.
Why did you make that choice?
Well, I think you have to do that. I mean, first of all, I think language is stabilizing as a result of kind of the ubiquity of English because of the internet and so on.
Really? I can see speaking some Chinese-ified English in 150 years.
That's a possibility, and it has to do with, you know, who prevails economically. But right now, English is the business language and so on. And, you know, I also think that if you're going to show something alien and exotic, you have to have a jumping-off point for the audience that's not too alien and exotic. And science fiction has historically usually been pretty terrible at predicting what the future will look like in terms of fashions and speech and so on. It just never really tracks that way. It's too mercurial.
So you didn't want to go Clockwork Orangey?
No. I mean, look, that could be a fun experiment in and of itself. But I wanted Pandora and its life forms and the Na'vi culture to be the exotic
that
element of the film. So the costumes are quite restrained in the in the live action scenes around Hell's Gate, the human base and so on, to give you a base and a foundation from which to then get stranger and more alien as you go out into the rainforest.
I'm told that some film crews used to wear T-shirts that said, "You can't scare me, I work for James Cameron."
Well, that was my Lightstorm softball team in the early 90s, and they were just trying to intimidate the other team.
And,
you know, it was said with a sense of fun.
But have you, in fact, as you've aged, mellowed as well, do you think?
Like a fine scotch.
Yeah.
I don't think there's anybody that's working with me right now or on Avatar that would say that I'm particularly a mellow person.
Right.
But I think the difference is, and it probably, if I think about it, it's probably a result of the expedition projects that I did in between Titanic and Avatar. I really was on a quest to find something more meaningful than making Hollywood movies.
Where you went down and made documentaries about these unprecedented undersea places.
I did documentaries, and I learned that art to a certain extent, and I have a great deal of respect for it now that I probably didn't when I was just a Hollywood director. And I've come to, I think, an understanding of a different relationship between the crew and the director, and a different understanding of the nature of leadership.
You're a better commander now?
I think so. You know, I never really considered myself a particularly good leader previously. I figured I was a good filmmaker. I knew what I was doing. But, you know, the passionate artist that has to pitch a fit to get what he wants and all that sort of thing. And it really, you know.
You were that.
I was that, you know, and I aspired to be better. But it took the expedition projects probably to do it. And, you know, did I get through 4.5 years of Avatar without having to pitch the occasional fit? No, but I think the difference is that my crew and my cast always understood that I held them in the highest regard and that these were personal foibles of mine, and if something like that happened, I would beg their forgiveness and say, look, you know, I've been up for 36 hours and, you know, that just happened, but it's not you. And I think that's a difference, you know, which is, understanding that to get the best out of people, you have to show them that you respect them.
Avatars, not in the sense of that you have invented them in this film, in the online sense, are very popular in video gaming,
sure,
online, and all that.
Absolutely.
Have you ever used one?
No.
No?
No.
So I guess
all my characters are my avatars.
So what about, though, these people, and there are now many thousands, if not millions of them around the world, who spend a good chunk of their free time as avatars.
Yeah, well, I think it's...
What do you make of that?
I think it's interesting. I think it's an evolution of human sort of social consciousness away from personal contact. and into you know, into fantasy, into wish fulfillment, you know, into kind of you know, aspirational fantasy.
Like your guy, in a way,
exactly.
He can suddenly walk.
Exactly. Now he can walk. Now he can do all these amazing things. So we're saying in the movie that it's quite literal, that this is a biological body. It's genetically engineered. That this is a real world. It's not a virtual world. You know. But it sort of taps into that same subconscious thing with people because they know Pandora doesn't exist any more than you know, Second Life exists in,
right.
in the real world.
Yes.
So it sort of taps into that same feeling. And there are some little cautionary messages in it as well because you see Jake forgetting to eat, not getting enough sleep, his body wasting away as he invests more and more of his life's energy in his avatar existence.
Sequel films are often, and conventional wisdom has them as being disappointing, but you made two excellent sequels with Aliens and Terminator 2, and Aliens wasn't even yours to begin with.
Right.
What is the secret to making a good sequel?
I think you have to honor the first film and, you know, honor the expectations of the audience and then play against them and go into new territory that feels like a logical or emotionally logical extrapolation from the first movie. And Aliens extrapolates very far beyond what the first film did, but is truthful to it and reverent of that first film. And so does Terminator 2.
So it's a matter of essentially not being a hack and just trying, hey, we made a lot of money, let's do it again.
Well, I think there's, you know, I mean, I would say sometimes the filmmaker or the writer and the filmmaker of the sequel wants to make it so their own that they actually work against what the audience would want based on the first film. Or they're so reverential of the first film that they just do a clone of it. And the truth or the best solution is in between. And you've got to have surprises. You've got to turn it on. You've got to turn it on its head. So you've got to find a way to turn it on its head, do a 180, at the same time being truthful to the first movie. And
right.
Terminator 2 is a perfect example. Tonally, it feels that has the same kind of grimness and intensity, but the Terminator's a good guy.
Yes.
So, you know, right there, you've
yes.
already...
So, you know, going near the shark without jumping it, I guess. Is
yeah, you don't want to jump the shark.
Assuming it's commercially successful, will you make a sequel to Avatar?
Yeah, and that's really the only criterion that you know, remains to be worked out is, you know, do we make money? And because, you know, we can certainly amortize what we've created. The whole world of Pandora and all the creatures and characters in it exists in hard drives right now. Can be very quickly brought back online. Of course, again, because of a sequel, you're going to want to not overplay the hand of what you've created in the first film. You've got to find new territory, and we'll absolutely endeavor to do that. I have a
You want to do it.
I do want to do it if we're successful. I love Pandora. I love what we've created. I don't want to sink into a 30-year you know, whirlpool like George Lucas did. And I don't mean this in a negative way. It worked for him and he enjoyed it. I personally don't want to do that and get stuck, you know, on Pandora for 30 years. But I'm certainly more than happy to do another film or maybe even two and slowly transition it out to another filmmaker to carry the ball so I can do other things.
So it won't take 10 years for the second one?
No, that would sort of defeat the whole purpose. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite movie that would surprise and shock people who know your work?
I don't know. Let's see. Well, my favorite movie is The Wizard of Oz. I don't know if that's surprising or shocking, but it is. It
goes toward there, yeah. Well, that's interesting. Why is it?
Why is it my favorite film? I've loved it since childhood, and I consider it still to be such an amazing, amazing kind of metaphor for life and just so beautifully executed, even though you can see the wires that hold up the scarecrow when he's on the, you know, when he's on his stick and so on, but... I mean, I know every word of it, and now that I have kids, and you know, our eldest is 19, and the youngest is 3. I've got 5 kids, so now I can share it with them. Have shared it with the older ones, and now I get to share it with the younger ones.
Well, in certainly in Terminator, and now in Avatar, that there are moments that to me were not unlike the house landing in Munchkin Land, and Technicolor coming on. That must be a sort of seminal impulse to try to do that.
Maybe. You know, I mean, one can only imagine what it was like to sit in a movie theater in 1939 and see it go from black and white to color and how magical a sense of transport that must have been. And, you know, my production designer on Avatar, Rick Carter, was always saying that in his mind it was The Wizard of Oz. And he even did this whole thing that he put up around his office where he had mapped all the different scenes in Avatar to The Wizard of Oz. I never quite felt that architecture mapped that closely, although I think that sense of wonder is absolutely part of it.
And if you play The Dark Side of the Moon...
backwards.
Yes. You talk about, you know, you think you're a good filmmaker, you weren't always a great leader. What if you had to say, here, my greatest strength as a film director is X, what is that?
I would say right now, having done Titanic and Avatar, my greatest strength would be the meshing of the technical and the human, or let's say the technical and the emotional, into a complete whole, which is neither one nor the other.
You on this film and on Titanic, you didn't work with a co-writer as you have in some of your previous films. Why is that?
If I know what to do, I'll just write it myself. Uh-huh. Because it's easier than trying to, you know, feed it with an eyedropper to another writer. But there are other, you know, for example, on Battle Angel, I worked with Lita Kalogridis through 5 drafts until we got a draft that we both loved. And, you know, so I like working with other writers as well. Just Avatar, you know, I just sat down and just banged it out in 95 and kind of wrote itself in a couple of weeks. I had all this imagery in mind. And so then I felt that I was probably best qualified to adapt it as a shooting script.
So the script from 95 is not that different from what we were seeing in 2009?
It's a template. It's not a solid blueprint. Uh-huh. It was a guidebook, uh-huh, you know, for what it ultimately became. But you know, all the characters are there. I mean, Jake Sully was called, you know, Josh Sully at mm-hmm. the time, and some of the other character names were different, and a whole bunch had to be taken out to make it fit in a screenplay form.
Uh-huh. Jake Sully, near the end of the film, says more or less, sometimes you have to take this big-ass crazy risk.
Yeah.
Seems to me to be at least part of the James Cameron philosophy of life in a nutshell.
Yeah? Absolutely. Leap of faith. You know, there's, you know, I guess it's a weird blend for me of being extremely analytical and choosing those moments that are leaps of faith carefully.
Uh-huh.
But still, there's a moment that's a leap of faith. And when we started this film in May of 2005, it was a leap of faith that we could actually accomplish what we were trying to do, because it was a quantum leap beyond what was technically possible at the time.
In the last several years, was there any moment that stands out as the most, I'm not sure this is going to work, scared, daunted?
Sure. I mean, panic was a way of life. A sense of doom was a way of life.
Until when, or at one particular moment?
Well, I think, you know, probably if you cut to a year ago, it was very hard for us to imagine that we would be able to get the film done. Now, we knew we were going to get it done, and we knew that it was coming out December 18th, and that wasn't going to change. But it was a question of how compromised would it be? How
really?
Hacked up would it have to be that, you know, that we'd have to take things out that, you know, it just didn't seem like it was going to happen. But fortunately, you know, the Peter Jackson's guys down there, under Joe Letteri and Eileen Moran, kept saying, it's going to be okay. We've done this before. It's all going to come pouring in the last few months. And you can't generate a linear scale from where you are right now. It takes a long time to get all this stuff working. And every movie, you know, every movie we've experienced this. And sure enough, it was true. I mean, we had 1,000 shots to go 2.5 months before delivery.
So up through this summer, you were still biting your fingernails.
Oh, up to 2 weeks ago. Up to 2 weeks ago, we were still working on the movie.
If it's as big as I believe it will be, does 2D movie making begin to go extinct?
No, I don't think so. I think 3D gets integrated into cinema, and this will depend really on directors. If directors want to make films in 3D. I think one thing Avatar might do, I don't think it waves a magic wand and changes the future. What I think it does is it gives people permission who are serious filmmakers to think about making a movie in 3D that they might not have. You know, and I know that for example, Ridley Scott came to visit and see what we were doing, and he had been planning on making a science fiction film after the film he's making right now, which is some variant on Robin Hood. I don't remember what the title is. I think it's called Nottingham. And he got very excited about the 3D. And I thought, well, look, if Ridley Scott, as serious an artist as he is, as consummate a visual filmmaker as he is, sees the potential in this, then it's going to evolve into a serious art form, if you will.
And now that you and other people have gotten a couple of thousand of these screens that can show it, there's now this pipeline that is going to demand it, presumably.
Well, we have over 3,000 domestically, and we have over, I think 4,400 internationally. China, for example, has gone from 500 screens to 600 screens in 1 month in anticipation of Avatar. So it's definitely changing very rapidly right now.
But you don't think it's a thing like sound coming in or color coming in where that within a decade it'll be that?
I think sound is the one huge change in film that's unequivocal. Color took 25 years to become ubiquitous.
Right, so you think it's comparable to that?
Maybe, yeah. And if you think about it, movies were still in black and white and color right up to the introduction of color TV.
Right.
It took a change in another area, in another medium, to force movies into color, all movies into color, to the point where, Woody Allen had to get a clause excluding himself from the requirement for color in his contract with Orion. And so, eventually there may be a Woody Allen clause for 3D that, some artist that just doesn't like 3D or maybe is blind in one eye says, screw it, I don't want to make a 3D movie, wants to be a purist, that 20, 30 years from now. But it'll probably take a change in another medium like television. And if television, as we absorb it in the home, is in 3D before it's ubiquitous in cinemas, it's going to force that change retroactively into film.
Yeah.
The same way color happened.
How interesting. certainly your career, one way it can be seen is as continually topping yourself or attempting to top yourself in, I've never seen anything like that before. Are you done with that? Or do you think, do you feel that's just what you do and you're going to have to keep trying to top yourself?
I don't know if it's topping myself. I mean, I think it's just I'm always open. I'm always curious. I'm always trying to pioneer new things because that interests me. It interests me as an end in itself, not because of its effect necessarily in the final film. Just when I imagine a machine or a device, I have to build it because I can't not know whether it would have worked or not. It sounds goofy, but that's how I think.
You American, you.
I guess so, absolutely.
How nervous are you? Here we are. This will be airing as the movie is opening, but now we're a few days away. Where are you?
Well, I think we're always, I'm always a little apprehensive right before an opening, but, we have tracking and we have the review process and all that. We've already seen that there's a pretty good acceptance of the movie on its own terms. To me, as an artist, that's the most important thing. Now we're just going to get down to how much money does it make. And, we'll just have to see. Is it going to be a big phenomenon or is it going to be a hell? I think we can say it's going to be healthy. But is it beyond that? We have no way of knowing right now. Even, Titanic was an interesting case where the film opened to a relatively modest weekend by current standards, $28 million. And now you regularly have big blockbuster films up in the...
But you made my children both sob, and I knew it was going to be a huge hit at that time.
Right, but it didn't fall off at all. Yeah. In fact, it went up. And our biggest weekend was, I think, the sixth or seventh weekend, which was Valentine's Day for obvious reasons. But, the film was number one for 16 weeks. So we didn't know until well into the run exactly what that film was going to do. And I think Avatar isn't going to be dramatic like that. But if I had to predict something, I would say that we probably won't know for a few weeks exactly what to expect.
Well, it seems to me, given it's very hard to market in a certain way, because if you just see a trailer or in 2D, okay, maybe, great, fine.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think in a funny way, for such a gigantically expensively marketed movie, you're going to have tremendous word of mouth because of the experiential necessity to say, no, it's really awesome.
Well, that and the emotional component.
Yeah.
Because I think,
that'll make girls go see it?
Well, we have found typically that women, coming out of the film, unless they're already kind of science fiction fans, but that would put them in a minority in the female demographic. Typically they say, this didn't seem like the kind of film I would like, but I love this movie. And it's because of the emotional component. And I don't mean just the love story, because I think it's a simplification to say that,
right,
women need to have a love story to
right.
go see a movie. Women are complex. There are other things going on. And
they just express emotions better.
They are more emotional, but that emotion might manifest itself as a response to the beauty of the film or the sense of wonder of
right.
the film or the sense of tragedy of the film, the tragedy against the indigenous people, the destruction
the nature,
of nature
yeah.
symbolized by the fall of the I don't want to give away too much here, but anyway, there are moments in the film that are quite heart-wrenching that are tracking in parallel to the love story. And then, of course, there are quite heart-wrenching moments in the love story as well. So I think, in general, the surprise on this movie is, and it's something that can't be conveyed by the marketing materials, is that it is an emotional journey on par with its visual spectacle. In fact, that's what Steven Spielberg said to me when he saw the film. He said, it's an emotional spectacle. And, you know, and I thought that summed it up. That was it, exactly, in a nutshell.
And do you want to just get away from it now and do something else entirely or take a year off? What's the plan other than going to Disney World?
I'm going to Disneyland. look, I've had to make a lot of promises to my wife and kids over the last couple of years about how I'm going to be there and be present and we're going to go on trips and all that, and I'm going to have to make good on that. And that'll probably be good for me to step away a little bit and get some perspective. But I'm not... I don't sit idle for very long. I do have another expedition planned for next year, and I've got a number of film projects
going?
That I'm... We've actually built a vehicle to dive to the bottom of the Mariana Trench, and we're going to do that.
And that's not been done?
It hasn't been done. Well, Don Walsh and Jacques Piccard did it in 1960 in a Navy bathyscaphe that weighed 109 tons. Our vehicle is about 8 tons. It's a little high-speed torpedo, and it's designed to basically explore. They went down, touched the bottom, planted the flag, so to speak, although they didn't really plant a flag, and claimed the record and came back up. So we're going to explore that whole trench system. And, you know, people always ask me, you know, what are you going to find down there? And I said, I don't know. We wouldn't go if we knew. We're going to take a look.
So that's like a vacation, a death-defying vacation.
My idea of a vacation, yeah, exactly.
Well, good luck. And James Cameron, thank you very much.
Hey, this has been a real pleasure.
Good.
All right, thanks a lot.